All right, we're recording. All right. No real formal intro. It's just me, Mike, and Steve. Steve, you're out again in your backyard.
I am.
Doing your...
It's because
you really get set up back there. You took a shower. You like dried off, got your scotch ready.
I got my scotch ready. I got a cushion. I got these like two sort of bug repellent candle things.
Mike and I are just sitting in front of a computer like two normal guys.
Yeah.
You're sleeping out back like a hobo.
I'm also, this is actually, my other choice would be I have to go into my own basement because the kids are kind of like going to sleep now. So this is also me avoiding waking anybody.
You look like a Ukrainian soldier. Like in Buckley. Hiding out.
He's like hiding out from like some, what's it called? Like the alligator. I think that's the name of that helicopter.
Yeah.
I couldn't see that article. What was it? The alligator. Is that
It was an FT article. Something like the title was something on Ukraine's counteroffensive stalled by Russian KA-56 alligators or something.
Helicopter?
Like that, right?
Attack helicopter?
Yeah. So something like that. It was not a, it wasn't a glowing review of this counteroffensive, I guess, is the upshot.
I mean, I assume that if they're not cheerleading the crap out of this thing and saying that the tide of the war is turning and stuff, it means that it's going pretty badly.
Probably a reason.
Because if it was going even like moderately well, it would be all over the news. But instead, we got to talk about these five dudes in a capsule.
Yeah. By the way, there was a billionaire in that sub.
Yeah.
How fucking dumb.
The Titanic sub?
Yeah. How incredible is it that you somehow made your way to $1 billion, yet you are still stupid enough to get into this little bathtub of a submarine and go to the bottom of the goddamn ocean? It's fucking wild.
See,
crazy.
I mean, this is we can talk about this later, but like when you have too much money, you just start to seek thrills of some sort, and it's gonna just be that, right? So,
I have this suspicion that he, you know, like the richer you get in those circles, I feel like in a way, the feelings of like the inferiority complexes don't actually go away because like he's now surrounded by like literal like Ubermensch, like You know, he's got to think of himself in a class with people like a James Cameron or whatever. Or he doesn't have to, but that's what he does. And he's probably thinking like, you know, because like, one thing I noticed is a lot of the, because they've drug out, you know, dragged out a lot of like the people who have done this before to get their take on like, you know, hey, what was it like going down there? You know, and they're like, oh,
yeah, like that reporter guy, David Pogue.
Though David Pogue says he was on the ship. He didn't go down.
So from what I understand, he was in the sub and went down a little bit, like a couple hundred meters or whatever. And then,
that's not much.
And then, and then they canceled it. They, because of fucking weather or radio comms or something, just wasn't working. And they were like, oh, we're scrubbing this one. And then he was on the boat or the ship, as they launched the other, like the next one in line, and then that one got lost for a bit. So he was never lost in the sub, but he was on the boat while it happened, which is wild, right? Because it's like, you know, you go out on this ship and apparently they do up to five attempts per expedition to get down there. And like three of the five or maybe all of them got scrubbed that one time. So yeah, dude, don't go in to or don't go to the bottom of the ocean
in like a homemade sub.
Yeah, in a fucking DIY submarine, dude, doing like 110 atmospheres. Like, come on.
Yeah, no matter how rich you are.
Well, I figure that you know, a lot of the people that they had talked to that had done it before were similarly, you know, rich guys that, you know, wanted to, they call themselves explorers and they say these like really like sort of like self-aggrandizing stuff about how they always wanted to push the boundary of human knowledge and experience, and
they'll say right, stuff
like, yeah, more people have been in space than, you know, at these depths of the ocean, and the future of humanity is in the ocean, not space. Meaning, I think they really want to see themselves as part of, like, you know, genuine explorer adventurer types,
yeah,
rather than mere tourists, which is what they are.
Yeah,
and I think like that these companies are taking advantage of that, as is, like, you know, companies like Blue Origin or Virgin Galactic.
Sure.
They're just hustling, which is why I kind of like these companies. They're like hustling billionaires to sort of offer them,
you know,
immediate like bragging rights and life purpose and meaning. But it's the advanced tourist package.
It's the Lawrence of Arabia fucking grift, right? Like, go to unknown lands and deep in the sea, you know, to the tune of like quarter mil to half a mil a seat.
Do you think Elon would go on his own Mars mission? I think he would.
I think he would.
Yeah.
I think
that actually would be pretty cool.
It would be cool. But I think if he had like a 30% chance,
envelope, you know.
Yeah, like I think he would go at 30% chance of survival.
I think he would after a certain age. Like after he's 60, he would do it.
Yeah.
You know?
He's like that the guy from the Weyland Yutani guy from Alien.
Right.
He'd be like that guy.
Yeah. Wait, Mr. Weyland.
Yeah. Where's Mr. Yutani? I was like, what is that? That movie was such a product of the 80s.
Yeah, Yutani uploaded himself into the cloud.
Jeff Bezos is fascinating because I feel like he's just going through this massive midlife crisis right now. He's got like this sailing yacht, which is actually kind of a cool yacht because it's different than those like super sleek modern yachts that, you know, that are all white and kind of look like the houses that all the billionaires build out in LA.
Mm.
It's like they're all white with like black glass, you know.
Yeah, it's very angular.
Yeah. But he built one that's more of like a classic sailing ship, you know. It's supposedly powered mostly by these large sails. But it's really funny because like in the bow, you know, like a traditional ship, he's got like sort of a bust of a woman. And stuff. And it looks just like his
like wife, the hood of a Bentley or something.
Yeah, but it's huge and it's a kind of a mermaid and it comes out the bow of the ship and it's got big boobs and it looks, people are like, dude, that's his fiance, Lord Sanchez. And he's just, you know, he's all jacked, you know, and he's like, dude, did you see him when he came out of that space capsule? I don't think technically ever achieved orbit. So I don't know if he counts that he went to space. It didn't actually orbit.
It's super funny. Lauren Sanchez used to do the morning show out here in LA.
That's great. That's funny.
She's like a radio or TV?
Yeah.
TV
person? Yeah, she's like a TV host. And there was this show called Good Day LA.
Mm.
And like they had a bunch of like hot chicks and like cool dudes on this TV show. And it came on.
Hot like, chicks and cool dudes.
Yeah. I mean, it's very LA, right? Like,
this is so like 80s.
Hot chicks and cool dudes. That's totally where he'd be fishing.
Yeah.
Remember that hot chicks and cool dudes show?
So this was like a 4-hour morning show. Like it would start at like 5 a.m. and go until 9 or something like that.
Wow.
So it was just like, if like this is back in the day, like maybe 10, 15 years ago, all the way out to like 20 years ago. And it was just basically the morning show, right? Like if you wake up and you're about to do your commute or whatever, you put this thing on TV and it would just be like the show that you watch while you're, you know, getting ready to go to work or whatever. It was called Good Day LA. And it was her.
What's
and like
interesting is she's not like that young, you know, isn't she in her 50s too? And she's
So while she was doing the show, she was in her 30s and she looked real good.
I bet.
Yeah.
But she's now sort of in that resisting aging at all costs and getting what looks like pretty extensive plastic surgery. And
it's a slippery slope.
Injections. She's got those like, she's got that cat face, that sort of like lynx face, you know, when they do too much injections in the cheeks and lips and stuff.
I mean,
she's starting to inflate a little bit.
LA is like ground zero for that shit. But I don't know how it is in New York, but yeah, out here it's...
You'll see that sometimes. You'll definitely see that. I saw it over the weekend. I was in my car on the upper West, and I saw a woman who was getting in a cab behind me, and I was looking at her through the mirror, and I was like, dude, that's like a runaway plastic surgery thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, she was probably 70 or something.
Oh, Jesus.
But she was wearing like skin tight clothes, and her face had that classic sort of like, I don't know what to call
it. Stretched out
plastic
look.
Surgery face. Yeah. You know,
it's a stretched out look.
Yeah. But what's fascinating is that Lauren Sanchez went for that look, and she nabbed the world's richest man. So I guess it does work.
Well, hey, you know, you can't argue with results.
She got results. She's on a bow. She's now the bow of a ship, you know?
Yeah, now she's on fucking yachts.
Okay, so...
Speaking of money. Yeah, speaking of money.
Speaking of money. So, dude, I feel like I'm potted out in terms of, like, I don't really have much to say anymore about... There's nothing left to say about, like, Asian American stuff anymore. It's just so... Like, what am I going to do? Am I just going to talk about the latest fucking murder? You know, like, it happened in Seattle.
Sad but true.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. You know what I mean? When that shit went down in Allen, Texas, I was like, I'm telling you, give it 3 weeks. It's going to happen again. And same shit happens. Just some woman, just fucking pregnant woman. You know, just, you know, like, so I'm like, all right, look, I've already said everything I have to say about these kind of events. I don't know if it's like worth going into each one that happens.
Well, you know, what's crazy is like back in the day, the Vincent Chin murder was like a big deal.
Huge deal.
Yeah. But now that shit happens like every month.
All the time.
Yeah. It's crazy.
And even more in some ways more horrific because, you know, even with Vincent Chin, like not to blame the victim here, but
there was a whole backstory to that.
There was a whole backstory. These guys were going at it for a while.
Yeah, no. It wasn't just like heat of the moment. There was a whole backstory to it.
Yeah, but like what happened in Seattle was literally she was just stopped in her car, and someone that she has no prior connection
with. It was just random.
Random guy outside the car just kills her. You know, that's the kind of thing we're dealing with now. And so because there's no backstory, you can't even show that it had anything to do with race. And so you can't even talk about this as anti-Asian violence because they're just like, how do you know?
You can only do it in like a statistical sense now.
You have to do a statistic, because the crimes are just so outlandish and random. They don't even have motivations. They're just people lost their fucking mind and they're just killing people. There's no
spur of the moment.
Like, there's no motivation to this. At least with Vincent Chin, you're like, oh yeah, it was this white dude. He lost his job. He was angry at Asians. He got humiliated by this guy in front of some ladies at the strip club. And so we beat him. Now, I'm not making light of what happened. I'm just saying it's understandable in terms of a story.
Yeah, there's a context.
There's you could make a movie out of it and it would have a plot. Right.
There's an arc.
This is just a hard discontinuity. I was going about my day, and then a bullet flew through the window, and I'm dead.
Yeah.
And so is my unborn child. It's
I
can't. Fucking there's sad. Nothing to talk about, other than just to mourn it. Right.
So, wrong place, wrong time, all that.
Yeah. So we'll talk about real estate instead, because
because the rest of it is just too goddamn.
Everything
depressing.
Is just terrible.
There's nothing that talking will do, or processing, or narrating this thing is going to do to get anyone to understand it more. There is nothing to understand. And so we're going to talk about real estate because someone in the I think I'm running out of shit to talk about. I'm not running shit to talk about. I'm running out of stuff to pot about. And so I'm like, you know what? Just talk about whatever. doesn't have to be related to any sort of like pressing racial politic thing or whatever. Not that I think we even ever focused that much on that, to be honest, per se. Maybe we did. I don't know. But someone in the Discord was like, talk about real estate. I was like, okay.
That's
good a topic as any, guys.
Asian people
The largest asset class in the world.
It is definitely the largest asset class in Asia. So there's
It's also an interesting sort of time because I feel like we're in an inflection point in the U.S. with respect to both real estate of all forms, residentially and commercial. And
that's another.
But someone said they wanted to talk about the philosophical underpinnings of real estate. I don't know what that means.
Who said that? The philosophical.
Talk about the philosophical
underpinnings of real estate.
I mean, I think the philosophy is pretty basic. Like, it's real. You can touch it.
It's a class, and it
cash flows. That's the thing for me.
Is this person talking about communism?
Etymology first, because you said it's real. I don't think you're suggesting that that's why we call it real estate, but it is real. It is the most.
Well, it's real. Real as in royal.
Royal, exactly.
Yeah.
Royal estate,
like Montreal.
Oh.
Yeah, Montreal.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's royal estate. It's this idea that it all derives ultimately from, at least under the English common law system, that it all derives ultimately from the domain of the king.
Yep.
And so,
I mean, and that's why they call it eminent domain. Name. Yeah, that's why they call it eminent domain instead of royal domain in Western democracies when they want to take your shit.
It's not communism, it's eminent domain.
Yeah, when they want to take your shit to build a freeway on-ramp or whatever.
Yeah.
They just snatch it from you. And, you know, like, these people are compensated. It's not, like, uncompensated, but...
It's unpleasant.
It's unpleasant. You get dislocated. And is it market rate? I mean, maybe market rate, but what are they... Like, they're rating it on comps, right? Like, comparable properties.
Yeah. They don't do it as much anymore as well, because it's just politically fraught.
Yeah, so, it's just real tough to do these days.
That's why I think there's a big problem with infrastructure building, particularly, like, talking about stuff like high-speed rail. I mean, the reason we like airlines, air flying, I think, is not just because it's faster. In a way, like, if you add on all the security lines and getting there 2 hours...
Yeah, for, like, a medium distance, it's not better.
It's not necessary. If you can, I think that you could do probably like, you could, if you got high speed rail going, you could make up and down the coasts.
Yeah, you can make it taller,
better than flying.
I think so. Like, if you take HSR, like in China, it's so much more comfortable than an airplane. Like, it's not even comparable.
Yeah,
like,
you just get on the platform, get on the train,
the train, and you have like double the legroom in coach.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's so many trains. They just keep
there's
going.
So many trains. Yeah, it's like every 20 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, so you don't have to like book your return necessarily. Yeah. Like, you could just figure it out when you get there.
You can figure it out when you get there. And
the airlines, you gotta like plan out your, you know, every moment. You're like, I gotta get there at this time.
Exactly.
Changing a flight. That's the other thing about flights, is like, changing a flight is not easy. Like, you're committed.
Yeah, no, it's
weird. Yeah.
It's not only just logistically tough, but financially, like, you basically have to buy another ticket.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right. So,
are you guys getting like dropouts, or is that just me? On like the connection.
Fine with me.
Fine with me. Maybe you're sitting in a dead spot or something in your backyard.
This is fine last time. Okay. Well, we'll just deal.
In any event, let's have a starting point here with respect to how to talk about the philosophical underpinnings of real estate. I think because it's a kind of inflection point. Oh, we really lost him. He dropped off.
Oh no, I'm here. I just cut off the
video
in case. Yeah, I cut off the video to save like an inkling of bandwidth. But since I'm just chilling
I'm
in my dark backyard,
it feels more not as outdoorsy as it was.
I could do like that. You know that thing from Speed where the guy just like replayed the same thing over and over. I could do that for you.
Right. Yeah. Who's that wildcat behind the wheel?
Okay, philosophical underpinnings of real estate.
Let's start with a proposition. And the proposition, I think, and a common sense or wisdom, is that it's really good and it's almost imperative to own a home. Is that still
true? Well, it depends on what your entry point is.
I mean, I think under that common sense rubric, it didn't matter. Like, whatever entry point, whatever income level or whatever level you're looking at,
it is better
to own a home than to be a renter, because renting is throwing away money, whereas buying is, one, locking in a certain amount of expense to, you know, your mortgage expense, et cetera. You're locking that in, and it's an investment. that will grow with time? And I think that is the starting point.
That is the question. Yes.
So I would say that on the time frame of an American fixed rate mortgage, either 15, 20, 25, or 30 years. Yeah. But the question is, can you support that asset? Because it's a high carry asset, right? You have to, if you're using a mortgage, AKA leverage, you have to be able to service the debt. You have to be able to afford any maintenance or improvements. And taxes. So it is insurance. A high carry asset, mm-hmm. insurance and God knows what else, but it is a high carry asset. There's a lot of extra costs associated with it.
I mean, I think in the States, you get interest deductibility. You get two advantages, right? You get interest deductibility,
yep.
on your mortgage. And number two, you can have 30-year mortgages. You can lock in for like forever. And you can yep. refi if rates go down, but you don't have to refi if rates go up, right? So you right. kind of get like a free option on that. In Canada, we don't get that, but we do get your primary residence is not subject to capital gains here. So there's no capital gains tax. Yeah. Yes. But we the interest is not tax deductible, and they're
that's
only
the same with the US.
5 years. No, you guys have to pay cap gains, don't you? Or is there some
it's capped. It. The cap gain tax is capped. Or
well, it's capped. Cap,
it's floored.
If you roll it into another purchase, then it gets waived.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
No, but if you don't roll it,
if you don't
you
roll
also
it,
don't
it's...
pay up to $500,000.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I know this because I sold a home and I didn't roll
it. Yeah. I don't know that because I never sell. My family never sells.
Yeah.
Okay. Never sell. If that's the case, then I mean, there's like clearly tax preferential tax treatment.
There's huge amounts of government subsidy for the home market, the home purchasing market.
Yeah.
Dude, there's a mortgage. There's a primary.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a primary origination market. And then there's God knows how many layers of secondary securitization of mortgages.
Mm. Well, we have the agency system, which basically is
which are now federally backed.
It turns it so basically like the American mortgage industry is centered around these government agencies, which wrap your mortgages so that the creditworthiness of a group of what they call qualified mortgages has the same credit profile as U.S. government debt. So right.
yes,
with a little bit of a risk premium, because I think that it does build in a certain amount of like loss, right? So there are loss barriers, meaning there can be missed payments and stuff. So there's a little bit of a spread above treasuries. There's no real default.
So on non-qualified mortgages, aka jumbos, the duration of those bonds or securitized mortgages is long enough that even low interest rates have a significant duration return, right? So that even if you're at 2-4% over a 20 to 30 year, or you know, let's say 15 to 30 year horizon, you're getting a pretty good return. Especially especially if you hold it to maturity, right? Like you're just getting cash. There's a coupon. I mean, it's a fucking mortgage, so there's a monthly payment and there's a coupon on these things because it's just, you know, it's not like a zero coupon bond where you have to just hold it to maturity and then refi it.
Steve, I would guess that U.S. agency mortgage bonds is probably the second largest asset class, fixed income asset class. After treasuries, I would guess.
That's quite possibly true. I know after 08, right, when the government sort of explicitly backed Fannie and Freddie, they like the spreads came in from the sort of like the credit crisis, sort of the GFC wides. And now they probably do. I think they do trade. To be honest, I'm not overly familiar with MBS. I think they do. They are going to trade at like a discount or like a yield premium, let's say, to treasuries. Part of that I think is because there's some kind of like spread extension or sorry, duration extension risk. Like if you think about, because it's a unit, it's a, so homeowners get unidirectional option to refi, right? Like if rates go down, homeowners refi. If rates go up, nobody's refi, right?
Yeah, so you have prepayment risk.
You have, yeah, you, it's like you get prepay risk. If you have high coupons, then you get prepay risk if rates go lower. If you have low coupons, then let's say like you got a stack of 2% MBS, right? To take an extreme example, and then rates went way up. Well, guess what those mortgagees are doing? They're holding on to that forever and they are not prepaying. So your expected duration is just going to be like, well, now you're just getting 2% for the whole 30 years.
Yeah. You're just going to
Meanwhile, market rates are 5 now. So have fun with that. Right. So there's a bit of that.
Well, there's also the
dynamic that led to SVB and all these bank failures, right?
It is an extreme version of it, but yes, it's an extreme version of it.
Well, yeah, because they were underwriting mortgages at below market.
Yeah, I mean SVB, I think they bought us a whole bunch of 10-year. I think it was Treasuries, but it could have been. It was MBS. It was MBS.
But it was
agency MBS. But it was like some low spread. It was at some really low rate, and then they got screwed.
But the point,
yeah, because they were hooking their clients up with below market mortgages.
But the point being also that they had these banks have two buckets of securities, fixed income securities. One is hold to maturity, and one's ready for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And if they held them to maturity, then you just get your return. You just get the coupon.
You get whatever you locked in.
But they had to transfer some of that stuff over to the ready for sale.
Yes.
And if you're going to sell it, then you're gonna take that loss benchmarked against prevailing rates.
Because the market price is whatever the market price is, right? Doesn't matter what you hold it at.
Fixed income is a tricky asset. You know, I think more people have been buying because I've been buying treasuries short dated, right? Short dated is a lot easier to deal with than long dated.
Like bills.
Yeah. So short dated, you know, like if you're dealing with 1 year, the worst that could possibly happen to you is you just hold it for a year.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas with these longer term, you get crushed if rates go up.
You can get crushed.
You get really good. Because what are you going to do? Just wait for 30 years?
Yep.
You know, you're not going to do that.
You can't do that. Yeah. I mean, it'll draw down, what, like 20 to 40% or something? The duration is crazy.
Yeah. It's I think a 10-year bond probably has a duration of about 8. So if interest rates go up by 1%, the bond price will go down by 8 times that.
Yeah.
Right. So interest rates. So like take last year or the course of Fed hikes, call it 500 basis points of hikes. The long end hasn't gone up by that much. But let's just say let's say interest rates went up by 3% times 8. That's 24% loss on your bond. All right. Have fun. All right. Like and most people don't, I think, realize that you can actually lose 24% on a bond, on a government bond.
Yeah.
Right. So, thumbs and shakes.
Yeah, I mean, especially when interest rates are low, the relative gain on or the relative increase in rates is, you know, I mean, it's basically like leverage, right? You know,
yeah, it's sort of a magnet. Yeah, it's a magnification. But I think this is like to bring it back to real estate, right? Like, okay, so the philosophy about, you know, should you just buy a principal residence? You know, that's one topic. The other angle is like, look, from an investment perspective, let's take a hypothetical scenario where you already own like your own kind of principal residence and it's kind of fine, right? So you kind of take that out of it for a second, right? Like I think, and I'm kind of the anti real estate guy as an investment. And there's two reasons for that. One is, from a portfolio allocation perspective, if you accept the premise that diversification is generally a good thing, and I think that it is generally a good thing. If you just like plunk down money for a house, given that the size of the for an investment property, right? Given that the size of it is usually pretty chunky, you probably just have that one thing. Maybe you have two, right? So in the whole universe of things that you could invest in, you've got these two specific houses in whatever city, right? So you're completely not diversified whatsoever. And then you kind of have to ask yourself, well, do I think I'm going to like house pick better than the entire market that is going to overcome the massive diversification loss? Like what if the city that you pick in just sucks, right? Like Detroit or something like that, and it went down for 50 years. So that's the first version. That's kind of like the first reason. The second reason is more structural, which is you have to ask, like a lot of people do real estate. Now, why do they do real estate? I think the first reason is that it is the easiest asset on which most normal people can get a whole bunch of leverage, right?
Yeah.
Because you can go put in Canada, I think it's like, I don't know, 20 or 30, but in once upon a time in the US, I guess it was like 10% down.
Or five.
So you can get 10x, 20x leverage, okay, on a cash flowing asset if you find a tenant. So for most people, there's no other asset that you're going to get 10x, 20x leverage on to try and take a giant punt. But real estate, you can do it. So that's part of the structural reason. The other part of the structural reason is kind of what, going back to this example of the bonds, you don't see the price move every day. So you don't have to look at, you don't have to look at mark to market. Right?
Yeah, and it's also like, you can't just sell it on a whim.
You can't just sell it on a whim. And it's just kind of like, I paid $300,000 and next month I'm going to think it's still worth $300,000, right? I don't have to like deal with, like if you buy $300,000 of stocks, next day it could be worth like, you know, 280 or 310, right? And you kind of have to like look at that every day and be like, oh shit, I lost 20 grand today, right? With a house, not an issue, right? So those are kind of like, okay, one from a, so, you know, going back to two reasons. One, it's not diversified. Number two, there are structural reasons why people do real estate. But if you can work around those structural reasons, i.e. if you're willing to just look at the price go up and down every day, right? And you're just like psychologically willing to handle that. And you are psychologically willing to accept that you're not, you don't need 10 to 1 leverage, right?
Yeah.
Well, then why compete with everybody that's doing this?
Yeah, so I'll just say that. So my family owns a small real estate business, basically, and our entry point was 2009, 2010.
Commercial or residential?
Residential.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
On the West Coast and like Vegas, and
by business you mean owning property?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So our entry point was 2009, 2010, there was no leverage.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic then.
So I would say that like if you're levering yourself into a real estate quote unquote business where you're, you know, charging rent and cash flowing and all that stuff, it's super tempting to do it when interest rates are low and property values are constantly going up because you're like, oh, this is an appreciating asset with low interest rate on whatever leverage you use to buy this stuff. But that's kind of a trap, right? Because if you buy real estate on leverage on the way up, it only works as long as real estate keeps going up, right? Because then all of your numbers look good. You're on the right side of all these trades. But as soon as interest rates go up, like they just have, and property values stop levitating, you're kind of just stuck and you have to hope that rents keep going up or else you're not going to be able to service this debt on top of all the taxes. And
is that because you couldn't get fixed financing for
no you can, but once the real estate starts dropping in value or not appreciating, You have to keep servicing that debt at whatever rate you bought it at, but there's no guarantee that rents will keep up with that, right?
But yeah. Why do you care about rents going up if your costs are fixed?
Because rents can go down.
Oh, so like, you're saying you just don't want rents to go down?
Yeah, you don't want rents to go down.
I mean, it depends on your financing structure, right? Like Mike said, his parents did it, I guess, without leverage at all.
With zero leverage.
So then, you don't really have a financing structure, so you're good no matter what, right? And I think
you just own it.
You just have costs and you have income at that point.
Yeah,
but you don't have financing costs.
Yeah, yeah, but yeah, I think most people are not in that situation.
Yeah,
this for the leverage.
Well, here's the thing: is that when rates are really low, you kind of are in that situation because I'm just looking at a mortgage calculator now. Let's say you took out. You bought a $500,000 home, put down 20%, so you financed $400,000 at 2.8%, which was a very common rate. Your total payments for the life of a 30-year fixed loan was $592,000. So the home is 500 is, well, I guess that you would add your down payment. But for a $400,000 loan, to pay it off over 30 years would cost you $592,000. So call it $192,000 in total interest. Rates, if you go to 6.5%, which is, I think, a fairly common rate today. Yeah, more than double. Your total,
like 800 grand or something, right?
Your total is going to be $910,000. $910,000 of that's total for a $400,000 loan. The difference there is, you know, $320,000 difference.
Yeah, and this is part of the reason why the Fed wants to target 2% inflation, right? So they want to maintain that spread, so that over the course of 30 years, the inflation in terms of the cash flow like rent that you can get on this property does not outpace the actual. It doesn't outpace the actual like inflation rate of the interest that you're paying, it does outpace the interest that you're paying, so that you actually have real profits and cash flow on a month to month, you know, basis when it comes to rent.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking at this from a structural market perspective, not any particular individual homeowner. They're looking sort of like at the aggregate, you know, interest expense for the in the housing market, right?
In the market,
and then looking at rental income in the aggregate for the market, and then comparing those kind of numbers.
Right.
But as an individual investor, I mean, it all depends on what your entry point is, what rate, your home is.
Yeah, and the thing is. The good entry points come around every, you know, 10 years or whatever, 10 to 20 years. And it's important that you get in at these good entry points. But the thing is, during those good entry points, credit contracts, right? The availability of credit and leverage contracts. So you have to be in a position where you can either pay cash for these properties or have a large enough down payment that the interest
is
not a big deal on the margin that you're not the margin, but the remainder of the, or the, you know, the equity portion of your real estate.
See, and I think like Mike, for obviously for your parents, like to pick up in cash in 2009 is amazingly good and fantastic timing.
Bro, I've seen the paperwork. So we have like a real estate trust. Tied to an LLC and all this shit. Dude, I've seen the paperwork. They were buying single family homes, like decent homes. Like one of the properties that they bought, it was a house.
Yeah.
$75,000.
In California?
In Nevada.
Oh.
Vegas.
Yeah, I believe that. Back then,
Think about it. So this entry point was you could buy a house that generates $2,000 to $3,000 a month in rent for $75,000.
The danger with that is that you gorge yourself, and then because the thing with houses is that they're not pure assets; they're also liabilities.
Yeah, there's carry.
Tax liabilities.
There's carry on it. There's carry.
They have maintenance fees costs attached to it, and the problem
not just that. Sorry to interrupt, but. One of the biggest risks in these kind of markets is if the tenant can no longer afford the rent and they get evicted, they're gonna fuck up the house.
Yes.
Right. And that's Nevada. That's Nevada. Like in New York, there's very, very favorable tenant laws.
We'll talk about Toronto in a moment, but yes.
Yeah, there's laws very favorable to tenants. So I have a friend, I bring this up because I have a friend who went to Rochester, New York, which is like sort of like a small market town in upstate New York. And he would buy houses for, you know, like five digits, right? He would buy like a $35,000 single family home.
Yeah.
And in his mind, he was like, dude, I could just buy up fucking houses, you know? And he built up like a significant, I mean, think about that. 35,000, he easily bought like 10, 15
houses.
It's
like car money. It's car money.
Yeah. You know, like he just with cash, right?
Yeah.
And so he's like thinking he's like this landlord, you know, he's got 10, 15 houses in this town And then he hired a local cop to kind of be his, like, you know, real estate enforcement guy, you know, going around picking up rent and shit, you know. But it just became a nightmare because he would lose money regularly on an annual basis, because first of all, that's 10 air conditioners that don't work, you know, that can go wrong. Those are 10 sets of like old pipes that'll burst at the worst time. Those are 10 sets of roofs that are going to leak. And then on top of that, he was running into like tenant problems where the tenants wouldn't leave and they wouldn't pay. And the cop is not, the cop's like, I can't kick him out. It's not legal.
It's not legal.
He's not the sheriff. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not the fucking sheriff.
You see, so, this is where like choosing your location. One of my biggest mistrades is not doing this in Detroit.
You think that was a mistrade? I remember when you were talking about that.
Yeah,
I
think it was
Detroit. Is still a piece of shit. So,
but it's a piece of shit that would have been highly profitable over the last 12 years. And
how far away is Detroit from Toronto?
About 5 hour drive. Yeah, I even.
Why would it have been very probable? Because like, because of appreciation and home value.
Yeah, or? Because like in 2010, rental income, rents have gone up from, I think back then, like the sort of, there was like the standard shitty Detroit suburbs house that was like two bedrooms, two bathrooms, or two bedroom, one bath, or something like that, right? And they were going, you could get them for like 35, 40, and they would rent for like maybe $700 or $800 a month at the time. This was like 2011. Now they've probably gone to 80K and the rent is like 1200 or so, right?
You would do better in stocks.
You would do better in stocks. You would probably do, yeah. Yes, you would have done better in stocks. But I think the thing is also Detroit, at least on a real estate basis, you can kick them out, right? Like it's like very pro landlord.
Legally you can kick them out, but can you legally, physically kick them out?
Yeah. Yes, well,
so you can send it. Apparently a buddy of mine did this. And if they're, what is it? Like 2 weeks late, you send the sheriff.
Okay, yeah. So, but there's like balancing forces to this, like in more, I guess, financially conservative areas where you can just evict someone at the drop of a hat. Like for example, in Nevada, landlords are actually always on the hook for utilities.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah, so there's like a balancing effect where, yeah, you can kick anyone out for any reason at any time.
But they're gonna leave all the lights on and whatever. You know.
Yeah, they're gonna leave all the lights on and run the fucking barbecue and the hot tub.
Yeah, constantly.
Or whatever. And the landlord is responsible for the utilities. So, you know, there's this weird dynamic where it's like, you know, the renter is incentivized to keep paying the utilities, but for only the reason, well, how do I put this? They're only incentivized to keep paying the utilities so they don't get evicted, basically. But if they do get evicted, keep paying the rent and the utilities.
Yeah.
For the reason that they don't want to get evicted. But if they do, they can run it up, move out, and then the landlord's on the hook for
handling all of that.
Utilities, yeah.
Okay, this is part of the headache of real estate, right? So
it's very local. There's a bunch of laws that you have to.
Yeah.
Let's shift from the idea of real estate simply as a side investment or an asset class, and also talk about primary residence real estate and whether
it's expensive,
whether it's an imperative for people, a family or whoever, to own their home, or whether renting is a viable option. I am on the fence on this. I've been a homeowner, and I'm currently a renter. And I would say that the issue is pretty complicated because a lot has to do with one, like rental protection, because in New York you get lots of rental protection. I'm rent stabilized.
Yeah.
And so when you start getting like, maybe here's a philosophical underpinning of real estate, right? The difference between owning real estate and renting real estate is a spectrum. It's not, there isn't, to me, a hard break between ownership and leasing. First of all, under the law, leasing is a form of ownership, right? What we talk about ownership, we're talking about a type of property, a type of estate called fee simple absolute. And what, when you're renting, you have a form of estate called leasehold. So they're both forms of ownership, right? And right. So from the legal perspective, ownership of real property is really a bundle of, it's a package of rights and obligations. It's not simply, this is yours and you're the king now, right? Like, no, it comes with a lot, like you could be taxed on it.
Yeah.
And you're legally liable for shit that happens on your property. So if you own a lot of large land that a lot of people come on to,
series of liabilities,
like, you're gonna get fucking sued if any of them get hurt on your property. Like all this stuff. It's not just like I own it like I own a car or like I own a, you know, like an object. And when you're renting, in some places you get more rights as a renter than you do in other places. So in places where the renters are heavily protected, like say here in my building, I know I was just talking to one of my neighbors. He grew up in this building. He grew up in this building and he still lives here, and his sister lives on the first floor. And they've been here for like 35 years. And there's like tons of people in this building that have been here forever because they can't be evicted and their rents can't go up more than the statutory amount, which is like some years zero and some years two. You know, they're it's going to go up probably 5 to 7% in this next round. And people are rioting over 5 to 7%, which in this environment is actually pretty reasonable.
Pretty contained.
Yeah, given that market rents in New York City are going up.
Yeah, also,
40%, like, this is a deal. This is a deal.
Also, it probably did not go up during the COVID era.
Not much.
By the way, the Toronto or Ontario rent guideline for the past couple of years has been 1.5. 1.5
rent stabilized.
Like
COVID year was zero, I think, and then 21 and 22 were 1.5.
Sorry, what's 1.5? Is that for rent stabilized apartments?
Like the max that you can raise the rent by is 1.5%.
If you're subject to that law, right? If you're just like a single, if you're just renting out like a second home,
the vast majority of rentals in Toronto are under rent control, I believe.
Oh, wow.
There's only a little bit of carve outs.
The way it works here in Santa Monica is every building that was constructed before 1979 or something like that is subject to rent control as a blanket rule. But anything built after that is free market. So it's very interesting. There's like a two-tier system where if you live in an older building, which implies that you're a longtime renter, you know, not really, but that's the sort of like implication or what they're trying to go after in having this statute. Like rent control, it only increases by, I think the worst I've seen as a property manager was like 1.2% or something. And during COVID, it was like $20 because, because like the owners had...
They needed emergency measures because everyone would have been evicted.
Yeah.
There was like rent moratorium and also rent increase moratorium and the whole...
That whole system of moratoriums shows you that, we're really... You know, it's not a binary between ownership and a renter. There's like a lot more,
nuances in here.
It's like a sort of like battle of like rights and obligations because like, for example, like in my building, the owner of the building, the landlord, is on the hook for all of these rises in like heating expenses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the fact that my lease, you know, I don't pay for most utilities except for electricity, but like the heating and water is all on the on the landlord.
Like,
first of all, that's by operation of law. They don't, you know, they would gladly put it on their tenants if they were able to, but they're not able to because of the law. And so all these rises in the cost of heating oil, which has been pretty, you know, during the in period of inflation has been pretty high. It's all on them. They legally cannot pass that on to the tenants.
They just got
to
eat it.
Yeah, so renting for me has really protected me. Whereas when I owned an apartment in Brooklyn, you know, every single cost got passed on to you as the, you know, as I was it was a co-op.
Yeah, you're a member of the organization.
Yeah, I'm a member, and as a, you know, as a owner of the building, all of the costs got, you know, just dumped in our laps. And let me tell you, when you're facing the full brunt of like the market out there, in terms of like what it costs to get a roof, you know, fixed or like a leak fixed, or like
you are out in the cold.
Dude, when you get when you see that engineer come to your building and start scoping out the structural problems, you know you're getting fucked. I mean,
dude, I just paid last year during the first set of like, so California's been in a drought for over a decade.
Yeah.
And like, I think not last winter, but the winter before, it just fucking dumped rain. Right. And right, our roof had to be replaced and it cost me $8,000.
Yeah.
As a special assessment from the HOA, which is the same as a co-op on the East Coast.
Yeah.
So the HOA billed us $8,000. And guess what? The new fucking roof leaks too. Right?
And it just becomes this, I mean, you know, you're owning a building. It becomes this ongoing saga of maintenance. And then we had this, you guys, I'm sure, have a management company. And yeah. So I was on the board of my co-op. And yep. I got to know sort of, you know, how this works to an extent. And we would have a punch list of just like big ticket items that the building had to go through. Right. We had a very old building and it was like, we got to replace the roof. And then we've got to do the, you know, you got structural problems on the back of the first. It was two buildings. The first building, you've got structural problems. Then we have a window replacement project. Then we've got to replace the cooling tower. Then we got to do this. The elevator
sewer pipes and all that.
So, yeah. Well, it was crazy, dude. Crazy. And what the management agent told me. He was like, this punch list is circular. So the way you have to think about this is you're going to get through this punch list. And by the time you're finished with the last piece,
the first thing is going to be
first thing's going to go bust again, and you just go through it like this. It's just a repetitive cycle of maintenance. He's like, that is called the cycle of maintenance. Do you understand now? And I was like, gun to my head, I'm out. Boom. Like, I don't want this, man. Okay, I don't want to be stuck in this circle.
You go back to this is actually kind of interesting. Like, you go back to the philosophy of real estate, right? And you guys are kind of talking about apartments. Like, I'm actually kind of curious.
Single family homes are rough, too.
Well, single family homes, I guess maybe the difference with single family home is that, like, the land theoretically has no maintenance, right? So I'm kind of thinking, like,
that's why they break out the property tax assessment to land and improvements.
Land and I don't know how it works in Toronto.
That's how
the
taxes
are actually kind of low.
The number of people I've known that had to regrade their backyard because the rain pools up in a weird way because their neighbor regraded. And so all the rainwater goes onto their lot. And now they've got to regrade. So it goes back into the other.
Competitive regrading.
Yeah.
Actually,
this is the kind of shit that they got to deal with, especially now with these like we got like monsoons on the East Coast, and so we get flash floods. And so my friends, you know, their backyards, this didn't happen when we were kids, but now that we get these like sort of tropical monsoon type shit on the East Coast, like they'll have like a foot of standing water in their backyard.
Oh, ouch!
Right, and then they all like three or four of my friends have had to have, you know, sort of like contractors come out and be like, oh yeah, that's because you're at the bottom of the land grade here, and your neighbors have comes onto your property, and so all the neighbors are in this like land grading fight to get the water.
I'm at a high point on my street, so
you're lucky.
Yeah,
so I'm gonna try to fuck with you.
That's a big thing when you buy real estate, you have to make sure that it's not in a floodplain and all this stuff. So I think there might be some reclassifications in the near future for a lot of properties.
Yeah,
you know, if you're at the low point and you're in a non-floodplain area, more precipitation might force a reclassification into floodplain.
So. I had a friend who lived in Palm Beach. I've talked about him a lot on this pod because he's a
he's like the plastic surgeon or something.
The surgeon guy,
ortho. Yeah, he's a hip guy. But he owned a house in in Palm Beach, or not Palm Beach, but like the neighborhood south of Palm Beach,
adjacent.
But it's on that barrier island, and his family loved it, you know, and he had a really nice big lot, and it was right not on the beach, but like there's like a canal that goes to the beach, so he had like a little dock in his backyard and everything. But he was paying something like $4,000 a month just for flood insurance because he was in a flood.
What?
He was in a FEMA flood zone. And when you're in a FEMA flood zone, what happens is that every mortgage underwriter requires you to go buy. You have to maintain. It's a covenant on your mortgage that you will maintain flood insurance, meaning not only do you have to go buy flood insurance to get the mortgage, but if you're unable to purchase flood insurance for whatever reason,
and we'll give you the mortgage.
You break a covenant on your mortgage, and you could get foreclosed on.
$4,000 a month is a mortgage. Like,
Yeah, exactly. No, it was more than his mortgage. He was paying more. I couldn't believe it because, like, he's a guy, like, you know, we don't really, he's a guy, you know, like, this is an example where, like, friends don't often talk about, like, financial shit. Mm. And so there are these big things where I'm like, wait, you pay more for insurance than your mortgage. He was like, yeah, it's a, you know, I got to buy flood insurance. And I was like, dude, that's a sizable expense, man.
Yeah. So,
but flood insurance is going to go broke.
Yeah.
It's a government insurance. That's the only available insurance you can buy is government funded insurance. No private insurance.
Well, so here's the thing, right? Like, insurance was designed to mitigate individual losses, not societal losses.
Structural.
Not like macro losses. Yeah.
So like, you can't buy hurricane insurance because they're like, that's a macro event.
Yeah. Well, same in California. You cannot buy earthquake insurance or fire insurance. They're just not writing these policies.
Yeah, and that cat bond didn't really work. I mean, I don't think the cat bond stuff really created a market for this stuff either. The catastrophe bonds.
Yeah.
You know, they were trying to use
long duration.
There's like a very long cycle to those things. Like at some point, there's too many losses, then prices go up, and then people are like, "Oh, you know, maybe it won't be so bad, and we can charge more." And then they go in, and then Katrina again.
Face it,
so.
you can't use capital markets to cheat nature.
Yeah. Sure.
No. Yeah. So in California, I've heard that within the last year or so, there are even companies that refuse to underwrite new auto car insurance policies.
What, because of theft?
Because of everything. Like new cars.
Oh, because it's impossible to fix cars. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, like to fix a new car, dude, like even just a bumper replacement is like there's a shitload of sensors in the bumper there's like all sorts of crazy like custom stuff to comply with like NHTSA and you know, whoever, like safety regulations, right? So like the cost to replace a bumper is like thousands of dollars.
Wow.
And the insurance companies are just like, this is ridiculous.
Like Allstate or something like leave California?
Allstate.
We're not fucking dealing with California anymore. It's too expensive.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, they'll honor like the insurance board or whatever the insurance regulators. You can't just like abandon existing policies, but you can definitely just say
we're not doing new business.
Yeah, you can just be like, we're not doing any new business, and that's totally compliant with the insurance regulators.
Yeah, and with climate change, the flood insurance thing is broken because after Houston, you know, that massive flood in Houston a few years ago, I heard basically like the federal flood insurance program is completely insolvent, especially if this thing's going to happen again.
Which it will,
and more often. So my friend like ditched that house. He sold it before Houston, and got himself to a non-flood plain house.
I mean, this has been an ongoing problem in Texas. Like, you know, Galveston, which is like on the barrier islands, basically. Mm-hmm. Dude, that place was underwater like multiple times in the early 20th century, and they had to like raise the entire. Like lift up the entire fucking town to like, yeah. They regraded the entire town. It's crazy.
I will say that there is something, I know people, it's going to be hard to shake this ownership mentality, but I do see an upside to there being sort of like an asset light approach, especially in a world where I think you're going to see more political, pressure to protect renters. More financial hardship is going to fall on landlords and owners.
So do you think this is the reason why big money is going into property ownership and
I think that they jumped the gun. Aren't they getting out of it? Like a lot of them kind of jumped the gun and then I know Blackstone was acquiring stuff and then now they're kind of like taking a pause and rethinking.
I think a lot of that was in like, I feel like a lot of it was in 2021, right? And in 2023, that might have slowed down a heck of a lot, right? There's like a lot of commercial real estate issues now as well. And just generally rates, look, you can just get 5% and sit in treasuries.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
Yeah. The inflation narrative is arguably somewhat damaged now, as well. So
not if you look at Europe, though.
Not if you look at Europe, no. Although it's falling a little bit in Europe, but you know, it's a kind of a. I do think though, like, to your question of, like, if you are talking about your primary residence, I still think that there is value in many cases, especially if you have.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying it's over. I'm saying there's a shift.
There's a shift.
Clearly,
yeah.
I mean, I still think most signs point towards you want to own your primary residence if you can.
I think it's kind of simple. It's like, if you have family and kids,
mm-hmm.
you probably want to own it because you just kind of want like the homestead sort of thing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you don't, then going asset light is very attractive because you can always just like pack your bags and, you know, fuck off at any moment, at any moment, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of comes down to
like think of, you know what's interesting to think about is the second home is like this is the vacation home.
Oh, the vacation.
Because home. I'll rent a house off VRBO or whatever,
yeah.
And I'll go in and I'm like, oh my god, this place is great. Like I would love to own a home out in the country where I can escape the city. I come here all the time, but then. You know, a couple times I've been out there and things have gone wrong and things always go wrong, especially when you're off grid. Off grid is a nightmare.
It's a nightmare.
You get all sorts of like backups in your fucking
costs are high out there, right? Because to get people out there to fix shit.
Yeah, you got to get every and the heating breaks all the fucking time. It's all propane driven. Nothing works well. There's no sewer system. It's a septic tank and that shit always gets fucked up. Yeah. And every time something wrong happens, you've got to get a guy. There's like one guy and it takes them an hour to get there.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, that's it. It's just that place. It's just that place and that plot of woods. And you better get used to it. Whereas, you know, like as a renter, I can just pick and choose. Every time I go out, I can pick
a new
house.
You can go to a different vacation home every time.
Yeah. And I can get a really nice house or a really small house. I could bring 10 people and get a massive house. Or I could just go me and my wife and we get a tiny house.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, you know, the advantages of being just like a pick and choose renter vastly. And when I leave, I leave. Close the door, boom, that's your problem again, right? Mm-hmm. It just vastly outweighs whatever interest there is in owning a vacation home. I don't really get the vacation home thing at all because I think, especially with things like Airbnb, VRBO, or whatever, it's just so easy to rent.
It's so easy now. So and there are so many people who just, they want to do that because for some reason they just, I don't know, they like to do Airbnb and they're willing to put up with the hassle and they're willing to put up the capital.
You mean to be the landlord?
To be the landlord in it, right?
And I'm just I think they're being tricked into it, to be honest.
I think a lot of them are cottages up here in like a little bit north of Toronto is like Ontario cottage country, right? Like the good cottages are pushing 2 million now or over, right? Especially if you got water. Look, $2 million.
It's all silly. Right.
Like it's come on.
It's silly.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But like, there are people with money and they transact these cottages.
You know,
it only makes sense if you have minimal leverage or zero leverage and you're banking on capital gains, capital appreciation.
Or it's just people with a lot of money. Like
just people with a lot of money.
With lots of money. Yeah, I think people with like $20 million net worth will buy a $3 million cottage, right?
But I'll tell you what, I had a friend who owns a nice big house in the burbs of Maryland. You know, pricey area. And, you know, he thought he was all topped out in terms of how much real estate. But he likes to, he keeps going to this one area, which is, you know, not far from him. It's called Deep Creek. It's sort of like the little mini Tahoe of Maryland, right? And you have really nice houses out there too. And he was, you know, he and his wife were like, hey, maybe we should talk about buying it, buying a house, you know, because they have friends that own homes there too. And they've got kids and they're like, it would be great. It's like a 2.5-hour drive. And they're just, boom, they're in this totally different house out in the woods, out in nature on a lake. And so they thought about it, just not like seriously, but then seriously enough for him to talk to the mortgage broker about it. And the mortgage broker was like, okay, you could borrow $1.4 million. He was like, what? He was like, yeah, you could borrow at a maximum. I'm just saying your maximum available, you know, credits. Borrowing power here is like $1.4 million. I don't know if it's he could borrow 1.4 or 1.4 was like the sort of
the house
higher end of the house okay. price that he could afford. Yeah, you know, yeah. with, I think it was 1.4 million was the house price that he could afford. You know, assuming 15% down or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was shocked. He was like, he couldn't believe that he could afford that.
You can't.
You see what I'm saying? He couldn't believe that he could afford that, and he didn't believe that he could afford that, even though that's what the broker said. I could put you into a financing situation where you could easily buy a $1.4 million second home. And he was like, he told me, he was like, I don't know what what little data like calculator thing that they have that makes them think that I should buy a $1.4 million second home.
Second
home. I'm not
second
that home. Guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I'm saying is like, even the people for whom like are looking to buy are shocked at how much they're allowed to afford.
That's the end of part one of a two-part podcast. Part two will be on the Patreon feed. If you want to join the Patreon, go to patreon.com/planamag.